Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, June 12th. I'm your reader, Dagna. We'll begin with today's mini editorial, which was written by Jackie Austin of Rock Rapids. And Jackie writes, "One major television news station did not find the hearings about the January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol newsworthy. Compelling testimonies presented were from people sworn to tell the truth. Either Fox News believes their viewers cannot handle the truth, or they know they are implicated and have been peddling fake news." Again, this was written by Jackie Austin from Rock Rapids. Our first article today is written by Dolly Butts, and the headline is, "Union County Historian Hopes to Help Unravel Mystery of Big Sioux Township Burial Site, North Sioux City." Union County historian Eric Rosenbaum has a list of nearly three dozen people he believes could have been interred over 150 years ago in long-forgotten graves in Big Sioux Township. A utility crew unearthed skeletal remains on July 31, 2014, along Interstate 29 near Exit 2 in North Sioux City, while laying fiber optic cable. The bones, which are undergoing further study, are thought to belong to roughly nine people who were buried sometime between 1860 and 1870. The site, which lies in the right-of-way just feet from the big blue sign advertising gas stations, is not marked by any historical maps or thought to be Native American burial ground. "I was interested like everyone else," Rosenbaum recalled of his reaction to this discovery. "I've always been interested in local history here." A couple of years passed, and not having heard anything further about the remains, Rosenbaum sent an email to the South Dakota State Historical Society Archaeological Research Center, stating that he thought the mystery of the individuals' identities could be unraveled. Rosenbaum also provided the names of a couple of people that might be buried there. 6 months later, he received a call. The Archaeological Research Center was interested in his research. Rosenbaum began his research with the 1860 census to find out who was living in Big Sioux Township at that time. He described its inhabitants as an eclectic group of people, which included retired fur traders, Mormon pioneers, and a variety of immigrants. You make a list of those folks. Then you go to the 1870 census and see of those folks how many were left, said Rosenbaum, who will discuss the graves Tuesday evening at the Point in Elk Point alongside Katie Lamer, the Archaeological Center's repository manager. Rosenbaum eliminated people who disappeared from the rolls or whose noteworthy deaths made local newspapers, such as the Sioux City Journal, which was founded in 1864. He also read numerous books written about the fur trade of the Upper Missouri River and turned to state historical societies and museums for information. "I've acquired letters from some people here in the Big Sioux Township. You can kind of use things like that to verify they were here and what they were doing. But it is a process of elimination. If the Sioux City Journal reported somebody died, bingo, that's a possibility. Then you go and figure out where they are buried." Rosenbaum's list contains 33 names, 10 of those people he calls high probabilities to have been buried there. William Kinsler, an immigrant from Quebec who worked for Pierre Chouteau Jr.'s fur trading company, Francis Lacharite, a bourgeois from Fort Vermilion, and Henry Unger, a clerk, interpreter, and guide for the American Fur Company, are among them. Rosenbaum speculates that the graves may belong to Ongi, his wife Mary, and their family members. He said Ongi had significant history in Sioux City and at Fort Vermilion No. 2, which was 4 miles west of Elk Point. A military button dating to 1820 and a bone rosary are artifacts recovered from the site that point to Ongi, according to Rosenbaum. He said the military button, an artillery one, could have come from the Black Hawk War of 1832. He said it's possible that Ongi participated in that war as a guide, as he was in the Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin area at that time. As a fur trader, one of the biggest articles that they could trade with a chief from a tribe was something called a chief's coat. All it is a military coat that looks like any other military coat. It would be blue or red with a bunch of brass buttons on it, Rosenbaum said. That was a highly prized possession of the chief of the tribe. They would trade upwards of 20 or 30, sometimes as many as 50 buffalo robes for one of these. It gave them a huge status symbol when they went back to their village. Rosenbaum said the fort's clerks would occasionally wear a military coat because it gave them status when trading with the tribes. One theory would have Ongi wearing a military coat, possibly related to the Black Hawk War, or he might have been wearing a clerk's coat, which would have been a status symbol for him, he said. Some of the remains belong to infants, which Rosenbaum said are going to be really tough to identify short of using DNA. He said the infants might not have even had names when they were buried. The science is going to solve this. I come up with the theories. The Archaeological Research Center uses the science, he said. With the exception of the infants, I'm fairly confident that we will identify the majority of the adults. If and when that day comes, Rosenbaum said it will be bittersweet. The journey has been so much fun, learning the history of this area. I knew there was a significant history, but not to the extent that we have, he said. And if you go, it's a presentation on the fur trade and the abandoned graves of Big Sioux Township discovered in 2014. And it's going to be at 7 p.m. on Tuesday at the point at 100 Truman Lane in Elk Point. And it is going to be Eric Rosenbaum, a Union County historian, and Katie Lammy, repository manager for the South Dakota Archaeological Center, will discuss their research of the historical burial site found along the I-29 right-of-way in North Sioux City. Our next article is written by Jared McNett, and the headline is Sioux City March for Our Lives event urges action on gun violence. Sioux City. In the past month in the United States, there have been four different mass shooting events in three separate states where five or more people were killed. 22 in Uvalde, Texas, 10 in Buffalo, New York, 6 in Centerville, Texas, and 5 in Tulsa, Oklahoma. On Saturday morning in downtown Sioux City, more than 50 area residents took part in a March for Our Lives event to recognize the victims of gun violence in those communities and elsewhere, and to call for action to ensure future cases of deadly shootings are not so commonplace in this country. This is something that is not normal, said Sioux City student Estella Ruhr Johnson, the co-founder of the local chapter of March for Our Lives. If you look to countries such as Canada, France, Australia, we see that this is not happening. It's only happening here. We need to see why it's happening, where it's happening, and how to stop it. The larger March for Our Lives group is a nationwide organization advocating for gun control legislation such as universal background checks on all gun purchases, upping the age of gun ownership to 21, banning sales of high-capacity magazines for guns, and bringing back the 1994 federal assault weapons ban. March for Our Lives initially held events in 2018, following the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, where 17 people were murdered, but revived nationwide gatherings in 2022 as a response to a deluge of mass shootings in the United States. According to NPR, the country has seen an average of 11 mass shootings a week in 2022. The Gun Violence Archive defines a mass shooting as one where at least four or more people are shot or killed. By one count from the BBC, some 450 March for Our Lives events were planned for this past week, including ones in Ames, Davenport, Des Moines, Omaha, and Storm Lake. With the Sioux City March for Our Lives events, which featured a mix of students, parents, teachers, faith leaders, and political figures, protesters started in front of the Woodbury County Courthouse and streamed toward the Sioux City Public Museum at 11:13 a.m. Downtown was not especially noisy during the morning, which meant those marching could be easily heard yelling, "No more silence, end gun violence, and enough is enough." People attending brought signs with slogans such as "Books, not bullets," "Stop killing our youth," and the word "Enough," written in a blood-red smear. One marcher, Terry O'Brien, carried a gun control sign from 1968 that was printed after Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. Also in the assemblage was a dog with a blue March for Our Lives shirt on and small children sporting Protect Kids, Not Guns attire. One parent and educator, Melissa Flynn, said she joined the protest in part because the issue of gun violence is something she has to constantly reckon with. "We actually have to do different drills. We have to do drills for active indoor and active outdoor shooters, Flynn said. It's asinine. This isn't normal. This isn't something that they do anywhere else in the world. I've seen these kids and their terrified faces when there are drills like this, and it doesn't need to be this way. After reaching the Sioux City Public Museum grounds, where the Who's Won't Get Fooled Again could be heard pumping out of speakers, Flynn got to voice those concerns to the crowd. Another speaker was Sioux City Community School Board member Monique Scarlett, who said she came to support the students she works with and to try and make the community safer. I'm hoping that our local government, state government, all the way up to the president, will definitely make something happen now. More concretely, Scarlett said it made sense to raise the age to purchase a firearm from 18 to 21 because those 3 years make a major difference in maturity. Per a study by the political research company RAND, 26% of mass shooters between 1976 and 2018 were younger than the age of 25. One of the final speakers of the event was Del Oliver, former reverend for Augustan Lutheran Church on Court Street. The great pastor treated the podium like a pulpit. He started by talking about the major changes in firearm technology since the Second Amendment was ratified in 1791, and wondered aloud if God sits in judgment of those who do nothing of substance after tragedy strikes. It is way past time for thoughts and prayers. It is way past time for hand-wringing and scrunched faces. It is way past time for moments of silence. Our next headline is Rotary Club Named Student of the Year. North High School senior Will Lohr, and that's spelled L-O-H-R, has been chosen as the Sioux City Rotary Club Student of the Year. He was honored during the Rotary Club meeting on May 16th. Lohr was chosen from all the previous Rotary Club Students of the Month during the past academic year. He will receive a monetary award, and a donation will be made in his name to a local nonprofit organization. Lohr is North High School Student Council President, Captain of the Cross Country Team, and Clarinet Section Leader in the Marching Band, and also active in Swimming, Track and Field, and National Honor Society. He is the son of Beverly and Peter Lohr of Sioux City. We're now moved to the opinion page, and we'll begin with an editorial by the Sioux City Journal Editorial Board. And the headline is, Too Many No-Shows in County Primary Election. Did you vote Tuesday? That's a question that usually breaks the ice with many people. But the answer, no, it's just a primary, doesn't always wash. We've seen candidates win races or beat strong opponents just because they were able to mobilize voters. And now, when there are greater restrictions on early voting in Iowa, that's even more important. More than 356,000 Iowans cast ballots on June 7th, the state's second highest turnout for a primary since 1994, when Governor Terry Branstad narrowly survived a primary challenge from then U.S. Representative Fred Grandy of Sioux City. Closer to home, turnout came in below the statewide average of 16.13%. A total of 8,865 Woodbury County voters, or 14% of those registered, participated. County Auditor Pat Gill said turnout was only slightly better than the last midterm election in 2018. The local participation rate was disappointing, especially considering the competitive Republican race for Woodbury County Attorney and a Democratic contest for a county supervisor seat were both on the ballot. Additionally, two Sioux Citians, Democrat Mike Franken and Republican Jim Carlin, competed for their respective party nominations for U.S. Senate. Here's the rub. Presidential years always produce larger turnouts. In 2020, a total of 45,641 ballots were cast in Woodbury County, a whopping 76% of those registered, matching the statewide turnout. But in off years, in a primary, you probably get better turnout at your kitchen table. What those non-voters don't realize is primaries can have resounding effects on the final outcome. Say, for example, you have three candidates for an office and two are less than ideal. You figure the obvious one will win because that's the logical choice. But if one of those lesser candidates does a lot of campaigning, motivates his or her base, and actually gets people to turn out, he or she could win. That one you thought would win is out, and now you're stuck with the one you didn't think was very good. Do you switch parties or go with the one you didn't want? If you had voted during the primary, you wouldn't have to worry about someone slipping in. It isn't hard to see results that have surprised us, or candidates that probably shouldn't have gotten as far as they did. But that comes down to voters. When issues can be decided by even one vote, it's important to vote for those who best represent you. And that starts at the primaries. Even though you may be tired of politicians and their grandstanding, you need to realize the importance of every election. In these crucial times, we cannot hope others will vote the way we want them to. It comes down to us. If you voted on June 7th, thank you. If you didn't, we'll be watching in November, and we don't want you to complain about the results if you were a no-show. Every vote counts. And now we'll do some letters to the editor. And our first letter is written by John Mansfield of Sioux City. And John writes, "In the morning of May 30th, I visited the one-half scale Vietnam Wall. I do this every Memorial Day and a few times throughout the year. I was alone at the site, accompanied only by the names of over 58,000 engraved on the wall. I have visited the original memorial in Washington, D.C. several times, and as always, I am drawn to the eastern side, the panels extending from 53E through 62E. I can't help but think that there, but for the grace of God, could be my name. From May 1 to May 18, 1968, our unit suffered 9 killed hostile actions and another 66, including me, wounded hostile action. I remember what was in 1968, then think of those on the wall, the forever young, and what might have been for them, and wonder what is still to come for us who came home. As happens every few years, Memorial Day falls on May 30th, this year my son's 48th birthday. So my thoughts are focused on my family, my wife, my son, my daughter, our 5 grandchildren, and all the days in the last 54 years which have been mine to cherish day by day, sadly denied to those on the wall. As I turn to leave, I remember an epitaph written by John Maxwell Edmonds. When you go home, tell them of us and say, for their tomorrow we gave our today. On Memorial Day, I believe nothing more needs to be said." Again, this was written by John Mansfield, Sioux City. Our next letter is written by Diane Howard of Dakota Dunes. And Diane writes, "I was shocked to see the A1 story in the Journal's edition on Monday about a May term class in whiskey drinking at Morningside University titled Cocktails Go Collegiate. Over 21 or not, it saddens me to see any encouragement for drinking as part of an adult life. Our country has been in denial about the short and long-term negative effects of drinking since the 1920s, despite the millions of drug and alcohol-related deaths that occur each year, deaths that are unnecessary and heartbreaking. I doubt the class syllabus contains the negative effects of alcohol after consuming no more than 2 drinks. How it impairs your judgment, causes you to say things you wouldn't otherwise, can cause cancer long-term. I could go on and on. People who know me will say I can't be objective. This is true, as I chose to stop drinking 35 years ago. Trust me, it is harder to do than you think. I am disappointed in the casual attitude toward a mood-altering gateway drug that can destroy your life in an instant." Again, this letter was written by Diane Howard of Dakota Dunes. And our last letter is written by Randy Giles of Sioux City. And Randy writes, "Despite having black bears historically, Iowa is desolate without them now. When one wanders into the state, it sparks people's curiosity. They are one of the most beloved of all wildlife in America. They are certainly one of the most photographed. If left alone, black bears can live up to 25 years, but females will only produce a few cubs in her lifetime. About half of her offspring will die before they reach their first birthday. But some survive, and one did and migrated through Iowa, likely looking for a home and a mate, only to have his life cut short by a farmer for no good reason. Americans have millions of encounters with black bears every year, and most are unremarkable. It's high time for the Iowa legislature to get busy and protect black bears and mountain lions. Killing them just because one can is simply shameful, and does a disservice to the majority of citizens who want them protected and conserved. And this letter was written by Randy Giles of Sioux City. We'll now move to an opinion piece by Dave Gomal, who is the president and CEO of Rosecrans Health Network in Sioux City. And he writes, "Like many, I am deeply saddened and disgusted by the recent events in our world. I wept due to the loss of life of African Americans simply for being African American, and the innocent children who were killed while attending school. As a society, how do we end these heinous actions? While there are many related issues which should be addressed, one conversation we at Rosecrans can tackle is stigmatization and how we speak of mental health. The blanket equation of mental health with mass murder creates an unintended consequence of stigma for those living with a mental illness. Our words matter, and we must use caution during this time of extreme tension. Clearly, those who commit atrocities are disordered people and perhaps have a mental illness. Yet, over 50 million Americans live with a diagnosable and treatable mental illness, and most have never contemplated violence against fellow human beings. Just because someone has a mental illness does not make them a bigot or a murderer. Making an overspread correlation between unthinkable violence and mental illness may cause those with a mental illness to retreat into the shallows instead of getting the help they need. Already, less than half of those who need treatment for their illness actually receive care. We know that early treatment and access to quality mental health care is a foundation for a healthy community. We also know that a lack of accessibility to quality mental health care services, stigma surrounding mental health, and discrimination are barriers to making mental health treatment attainable. As a community, we must fight the stigmatization of behavioral health conditions wherever it exists. We must make serious investments into funding for mental health, and we must afford treatment early to improve access, or the mental health crisis will continue to go underaddressed. I am so grateful for Rosecrans, an exquisitely diverse community of humans who champion hope every day. In their own way, each of our staff stand, fight stigma, and help those in need. Let's show those who are hurting that life truly is waiting." And again, this is written by Dave Gomel, who is the president and CEO of Rosecrans Health Network in Sioux City. We now move to the sports section, and our first story is high school softball. Helan rallies in win over East. In the first game of a doubleheader at Shields Field in Sioux City on Saturday, the Bishop Helan High School softball team defeated East 8-5. "The girls are just getting more confidence, and they're having fun," Helan coach Chris Fitzpatrick said. "When they have fun, they play better. They play looser. So that's exciting to see them playing and having fun doing what they're doing." Helan entered play Saturday after playing a pair of games in Lamar's Friday. East had not played since a doubleheader with Council Bluffs Jefferson on Tuesday. The doubleheader between Helan and East was originally scheduled for Thursday, but was pushed to Saturday due to the weather. East jumped ahead of Helan starter Angel Shaw in the first inning as Olivia Menser drove in Briley Hempy on a single. Helan wasted no time responding to the run in the top of the first, scoring two of their own in the bottom of the inning. An RBI double by Grace Nelson, followed by a Marin Frazee RBI base hit, gave Helan a one-run advantage after one. Both pitchers, Shaw for Helan and Hempy for East, pitched clean second innings, but Shaw struggled again in the third. After getting the leadoff runner out, Hempy walked and Gracie Bruning singled. A sacrifice fly by Raylan Angelman scored Hempy, and Bruning scored on a wild pitch in the next at-bat to give East the advantage again. Helan broke things open in the fourth inning. After a 1-2-3 inning for Shaw in the circle, the Crusaders struck the four runs in the bottom of the inning. And staying with the softball, we moved to a story on West Lyon and Sergeant Bluff Luton. Madison DeYoung stepped into the circle Friday with a tough task, holding down Sergeant Bluff Luton's offense enough for her West Lyon teammates to pick up a win. DeYoung, who pitched 3 shutout innings in the 9-5 loss to the Warriors just a week prior, gave up 4 runs over 7 innings in a 6-4 win at Sergeant Bluff Luton Friday night. It has been a long couple of weeks and played a lot of games, West Lyon head coach Jeremy Childress said. On the long road trip coming down, I could tell the girls were worn out a little bit, but they're just a group that's ready to play, ready to have fun. Maddie DeYoung, our pitcher tonight, she's had a couple of rough outings, and for her to come in and throw to a team like Sergeant Bluff Luton really says a lot about her. We knew it was eventually going to click for her, and it did tonight. Not a better place or a time for it. Not only did DeYoung have a strong performance in the circle, but she had 2 hits and 2 RBIs at the plate to help the Wildcats. DeYoung's 2-run single in the first gave her team a 3-0 lead before the Warriors even had a chance to swing the bats. She's worked really hard, does all the right things, so I couldn't be happier for her. And of course, we had really good defense behind her tonight, Childress said. We had key hits when we needed them. There were a couple of situations where we'd like to see a base knock in through their girls. Need to step up there. But Maddie threw incredible, and the defense was awesome. DeYoung, along with classmates Randy Childress and Maddie Johnson, have played vital roles in West Lyon's 10-3 start for the season. Childress leads the team with a 524 batting average and has 2 home runs and 13 RBI to her name. DeYoung is batting 395 with 15 RBI, and Johnson is hitting 250 in 20 at-bats. The junior class is being able to shine in large part to the leadership of the senior class, Childress said. The 5 seniors are the leaders for the Wildcats and are having a strong season themselves. Xavier Metzger is hitting 409 with 4 home runs and 21 RBI, both team highs. Shay Langenhorst drove in a run Friday night, her 11th on the season, while hitting 385. The other 3 seniors, Mallory Gramstead, Morgan Grotewald, and Isabel Heyer, also play big roles in the team's success. Maddie DeYoung, Randy Childress, and Maddie Johnson played really well, really stepping up their game. But really, with our 5 seniors and their leadership, that allows those juniors to do what they do, Childress said. So they all accepted their roles on the team, all willing to play for each other, celebrate each other, and it's just such a lot of fun being around this group. The 6-4 win over the Warriors gives West Lyon a much-needed win over a ranked opponent and gives the girls a confidence boost after a couple long weeks. West Lyon has won 6 of their last 7 games as they continue the second half of their season next week. It just builds confidence, Childress says. We have a big couple of weeks with our conference play coming up and still in the hunt for that conference championship, so hopefully it can spring us forward and we can keep playing well. For Sergeant Bluff Luton, the loss was a bit of a wake-up call for the group. The Warriors were riding a 9-game winning streak entering Friday, in which they had a couple of great breaks to help them along the way. This game is nasty, and if you don't execute, you're not going to win, Warriors head coach Jared Ocker said. We've kind of been fortunate to win some games where other teams have kind of kicked it, and tonight wasn't our night. A loss like Friday's, where the team committed 6 errors to allow 3 unearned runs to score in the second half of the game, is a good thing for learning experiences and is something the team still has to learn from moving forward. I wish we had competitive games like this every night, Ocker said. That's how you're going to grow as a team, and girls start to see that 60 feet matters, and whether it's in the air, getting the button down, or not getting out on the bunt. So those are good learning experiences for everybody. The Warriors are young on paper, but not in experience. There is a group of 5 freshmen who have varsity playing experience and are making a big impact for the Warriors this season. The top team in the Missouri River Conference standings is led by Brooklyn Ocker and Emma Crooks, both freshmen for the Warriors. Ocker at 449 and Crooks 429 are first and second on the team in batting average, and Ocker leads the team with 21 RBIs. Crooks went 3-for-3 with 3 RBIs Friday night, and Ocker pitched 5 innings, allowing no earned runs. I think just the want to be out there. I mean, they want to be in the lineup. They want to compete, Ocker said. They don't care the level last year as eighth graders. They both played almost 60 games at different levels, pitching freshman, JV, and suiting up hitting on the varsity a little bit. It's nice to see them compete, and they love softball, love being out there. It'll be a fun 3 more years with both of them, and they're going to have big roles for us. They obviously have so far this year, Ocker continued. Crooks holds the best ERA on the team at 1.40 over 25 innings. Ocker has a 3.55 ERA and 24 strikeouts over 25 and two-thirds innings. Addison Wheeler is hitting 3.72 with 2 home runs and 11 RBI as well. It's a big week upcoming for the top team in the MRAC as the Warriors face West in a doubleheader Tuesday and face East in a tripleheader on Thursday. We want to win a conference title, and so you use those in-town rivalries to motivate us, Ocker said. We have a doubleheader with West on Tuesday and 3 big ones with East on Thursday, so that's always motivation and opportunities to show up and compete every day. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, June 12th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It is now time for the obituaries in today's paper. We will begin with Joyce Marilyn Lake, 88, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully Tuesday, June 7th, surrounded by family in Phoenix, Arizona. Services will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday at Grace United Methodist Church in Sioux City. Visitation will be 1 hour before the service at church. Burial will immediately follow at Hillside Cemetery in Merrill. Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel is handling the arrangements. Joyce Thiel was born April 25, 1934, in Wahpeton, North Dakota. She was the daughter of Harvey and Florence Warner Thiel. The family moved to Great Bend, North Dakota, where she lived from infancy until graduating from Wahpeton High School in 1952. She attended Westmar College in Lamar's and graduated in 1956 with a degree in business education. She taught high school in Lawton for 3 years. Joyce married Darrell E. Lake on June 7, 1958, after which she became the secretary for Sergeant Bluff Schools, where Darrell taught music. The couple moved to Sioux City in 1964 with their infant daughter, Jana Lynn. Deanna Lynn joined the family in 1965 and Douglas Grant in 1971. They joined Grace United Methodist Church in 1963, where Joyce was active in Mother's Club, UMW circles, numerous committees, and many volunteer activities. She also volunteered at the soup kitchen, St. Luke's Women's Auxiliary, and had served on the board of the Boys and Girls Home. Joyce had a huge heart, and her life was marked by generosity to those in need. She enjoyed flowers, animals, music, reading, and treasured her family and friends. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association. So the Alzheimer's Association, 225 North Michigan Avenue, floor 17, Chicago, Illinois, 60601. Douglas W. Pierce, Sr., Hemet, California, formerly of Sioux City, 76, died Saturday, June 4th. Renee Marianne Park Brown passed away so peacefully on Friday, February 11th, as her son, Ken, played guitar for her and sang some of her favorite hymns and John Denver songs at her bedside. She opened her eyes widely one last time and took her final breath during the chorus of Back Home Again. Services planned for 11 a.m. on Thursday at Gill Brothers Funeral Home, 9947 Lindell Avenue, Bloomington, Minnesota, with a luncheon to follow. Private interment will be at Fort Snelling National Cemetery. Arrangements are by Gill Brothers Funeral Home in Bloomington. Online condolences may be made at gillbrothers.com. Renee was born on June 15, 1934, in St. Paul to Norbert and Marianne Park. She graduated high school from St. Paul Central and graduated from McAllister College, where she met Ward. They were united in marriage on her birthday, June 15, 1956. Renee was the third of 6 siblings. By the early age of 34, both her beloved parents had succumbed to cancer. She loved to entertain and set a table with a marvelous feast. She and Ward loved dogs, music, dancing, and ice skating, and many fishing trips together to the Lake of the Woods. She and Ward had many friends from their days in Sioux City and Plymouth, Minnesota. They were always active together in the church congregations and the communities they lived. For over 10 years, she was so lovingly cared for in assisted living and memory care in River Falls, Wisconsin, at Comforts of Home. St. Croix Hospice staff and nurses provided such exceptional care for her these past days and for over 2 years, and they became like a family. Renee had a very strong, determined faith in Jesus. She was a friend of his, and he knew her well. A video was taken of her just a few weeks ago, beautifully singing a hymn in the garden. It was the last lucid moment we have of her, and find it amazing what one remembers when Alzheimer's erases everything else. Memorials are preferred to the Alzheimer's Association, St. Croix Hospice, and the Austin Strong Foundation Inclusive Playground. Clifford J. Cliff Collette, 84, of North Sioux City, passed away Thursday, June 9th at local care center. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 1:30 p.m. on Monday at Sacred Heart Catholic Church with Father Terry Roeder officiating. Visitation will begin at 12:30 on Monday at the church. Visitation with the family will be from 5 to 7 p.m. today, with a Knights of Columbus Rosary service at 6 p.m. and a vigil service at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery. Cliff was born July 27, 1937 in Concordia, Kansas, the son of Joseph and Amanda Collette. The family moved to North Sioux City, which was formerly called Stevens, when he was 2. He attended Sacred Heart School and graduated from Helan High School in 1955. Cliff married Joanne Gerard on July 16, 1960 in Vining, Minnesota. To this union, 3 daughters and 2 sons were born. Cliff's favorite saying was, he worked on the same corner of 3rd and Steuben at Holmes and Hudson, eventually becoming Guardian Building Supply for 35 years before retirement. He enjoyed golfing, cards especially card club, watching the Green Bay Packers play, and reading a good Western book. Cliff also kept busy with bingo, church dinners, and his many roles and offices held at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, and as a volunteer for Hospice of Siouxland. He also was a member of the Knights of Columbus and the Lumbermen's Association, once receiving Manager of the Year Award. Adeline Johnson, Sioux City, 72, died Friday, June 10th. Services will be June 15 at 2 p.m. at the Christy Smith Funeral Home Morningside Chapel at 1801 Morningside Avenue, Sioux City. Visitation will be June 15th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the funeral home. Judith D. Judy Clark, 84, Gainesville, Florida, and Sioux City, passed away peacefully while surrounded by family members on Saturday, June 4th. Celebration of life service will be held at a future date with arrangements made with Forest Meadows Funeral Home. Judy was born December 23, 1937 in Sioux City. As a young adult, Judy met the love of her life, Marion Clark, whom she was married to for 55 years prior to his death in 2013. In 1971, while raising their 3 young children, Kim, Terry, and Kevin, Judy and Marion moved to College Station, Texas, where Judy earned a bachelor's degree in education at Texas A&M University, one of the first females to earn a degree from the all-male cadet university at that time. The next stop for the family was to Boonesboro, Maryland, where Judy taught students at Fountain Rock Elementary for 4 years. In 1976, Judy and her family moved to the Navajo Indian Reservation in Window Rock, Arizona, where she taught middle school social studies. The next year, 1977, brought transition and new opportunities again, this time in Gainesville. Here, Judy elevated her passion for education, earning a master's degree in education from Nova Southeastern University, while raising a family and working for the Alachua County School System as a middle school teacher in social studies. She taught school in Alachua County for 22 memorable years at Mebane Middle School and Westwood Middle School, where she retired in 2010 as dean. Judy cherished her students as well as the lasting friendship created with colleagues during her years at Mebane and Westwood. Judy was a dear and loving friend to her ladies' groups in Gainesville, a loyal and lasting friend to those she met across the country, and a woman who cared for and loved her family deeply. She was known to keep in communication with many by sending homemade handwritten cards periodically for special occasions or just to say hi. She was her children's and her grandchildren's biggest fan, never missing the chance to see them compete in their favorite sports. She spent more time attending youth sports programs than she could ever count, planning to attend more just before her passing. Judy also loved spending time in her cabin in the North Carolina mountains, where she enjoyed entertaining many friends and family. The family wishes to thank the Windsor of Gainesville Assisted Living Facility, where the staff cared for her so compassionately, helping make her final chapter a peaceful and comfortable conclusion to her wonderful life. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that donations be made to the Education Foundation of Alachua County in Judy's names. And details for donations can be found at edfoundationac.org. Alan E. Wingert, Mobile, Iowa, 80, died Thursday, June 9th. Services will be June 13 at 10:30 a.m. at St. John Lutheran Church in Climbing Hill. Burial will be at a later date. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the church. Arrangements with Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Mobile. Mary E. Singer, Sioux City, formerly of Brunsville, Iowa, 76, died Thursday, June 6th. Services will be June 16th at 7 p.m. at the Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. Burial will be at a later date at the Rest Haven Memory Gardens, Lamars. Visitation will be June 16th from 2 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Lowell Clarence Stading, Ponca, Nebraska, 87, died Wednesday, June 8th. Services will be June 13th at 10:30 a.m. at the Salem Lutheran Church, Ponca. Burial will be the Ponca City Cemetery. Visitation will be June 12th from 5 to 7 at the church. Arrangements with Moore Funeral Home in Ponca. Terry L. Oliver Sr., Sioux City, 59, died Monday, June 6. Services will be June 14th at 2 p.m. at the Nelson Berger Northside Chapel in Sioux City. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Barbara Jean Connect, Lamars, Iowa, 87, died Friday, December 24th, 2021. Burial will be at a later date at Riverside Cemetery, Akron, Iowa. Visitation will be June 19th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars. George Hardy, 93, of Mission, Texas, formerly Pearson, Iowa, passed away Wednesday, February 23rd in Houston, Texas. Graveside service will be held at 3 p.m. on Monday at Kingsley Cemetery, Kingsley, Iowa, with military rites provided by American Legion Nash Post 140 of Kingsley and the U.S. Army. Visitation will follow this graveside service from 4 to 7 p.m. with the family present at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Road Funeral Home is handling funeral arrangements. George was born January 28, 1929, in Sioux City, the son of William D. and Hilda L. Hinkhouse Hardy. He attended a one-room school throughout his elementary years before attending Pearson High School and graduating in 1946. Following graduation, he attended Wayne State College before moving back to Pearson, where he began farming 1 mile north of Pearson. George and Lena Slaud of Kingsley were married March 25, 1951, prior to George entering the U.S. Army. George served 2 years as a special agent with the Armour County Intelligence. Following his honorable discharge, he and Lena moved to Pearson, where they farmed and raised their daughters, Leslie and Lisa. After farming, George worked at Wells Blue Bunny in Lamars until his retirement. He and Lena enjoyed golfing, square dancing, and playing cards. Also, George enjoyed snow skiing and was very active in the First Christian Church of Pearson, serving as a deacon and elder. George was also a member of the Masonic Lodge, where he served as a master, was a 49-year member of the Abu Becker Shrine, participating in the Hospital Dads and the Clown Unit. He was an active member of Eastern Star and of the American Legion and the Elks. George and Linus were able to winter in Mission for 3 years until Linus passed away unexpectedly December 7, 1999. George continued to go to Texas during the winter months, where he met Geraldine Whitmer. George married Jerry Whitmer and sold the acreage and moved permanently to Mission. He was happy about living right next to a golf course. 1 year he golfed 400 rounds. He and Jerry loved to go dancing and often would go 3 to 4 nights a week. Memorials may be directed to the Kingsley Pearson FFA. Burton and Jean Baker, Sergeant Bluff. On May 7, 2022, Burton and Jean Baker, longtime residents of Sergeant Bluff, were laid to rest at a graveside ceremony at the Sioux City Memorial Park Cemetery. Burton passed away Monday, September 18, 2014, and Jean passed away on Sunday, January 9, 2022. Present at the service were Gary and Beth Baker and Janet and Dan Lever, four granddaughters and their spouses, and seven great-grandkids. Pastor Darren Adkins of the Sergeant Bluff Methodist Church was present for the ceremony. Helen and Burdell Vohs, and that's spelled V-O-H-S, Battle Creek, Iowa. Helen M. Vohs, 93, died Monday, June 6. Burdell H. Vohs, 96, died Thursday, November 26, 2020. Services will be June 17th at 11 a.m. at St. Paul Evangelical Lutheran Church in Holstein. Burial will be at the Mount Hope Cemetery, Battle Creek, with military rites. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the church. Arrangements with Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein. Sally Elizabeth Shull Connor, 99, passed away on Monday, June 6, at Bickford Senior Living in Sioux City. A private service for the family will be held at a later date. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is assisting the family. Sally was born on August 2, 1922, to Marguerite Claire Shull and DeLoss Perkins Shull. She graduated from Central High School in 1940, attended McMurray College in Jacksonville, Illinois, then transferred to Northwestern University in Evanstown, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, graduating with honors in 1945. Sally was a member of the Delta 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 sorority. She worked for the school system in San Mateo, California, before returning to Sioux City, where she was employed as a psychometrist by the Sioux City Board of Education, doing intelligent testing of problem children referred by their teachers. Sally was married February 18, 1950 to R. Dudley Connor and became a homemaker, raising two sons, William and John. After several years, her husband's career was transferred to Denver, where their family moved and where their daughter Susan was born. Several years later, they returned again to Sioux City, where her husband became president of Knapp & Spencer Wholesale Hardware Company, which was founded in 1868 by Sally's grandfather, C.A. Knapp. Upon retirement in 1983, Sally and her husband became winter residents of Fort Myers, Florida for 19 years, spending summers at Okoboji, Iowa before returning to Sioux City in 2002. When young, Sally enjoyed spending summers with her family at Spirit Lake, Iowa, and later after marriage at Okoboji. She was a lifelong member of the First United Methodist Church, a former member of both the Sioux City Junior League and the American Association of University Women, and a sustaining member of Portfolio Book Club. She enjoyed reading, especially science, inspirational materials, biographies, and history. Sally enjoyed time spent with her family and also enjoyed activities, including lifelong learning classes at Western Iowa Tech. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to First United Methodist Church at 1915 Nebraska Street, Sioux City, or the charity of anyone's preference. Cassandra Ann Casey Junk, Ida Grove, 57, died Thursday, June 9th. Services will be June 17th at 10:30 a.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church, Ida Grove. Following service will be the burial at Ida Grove Cemetery. Visitation will be June 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home in Ida Grove. And that concludes the obituaries for today. We'll now move to a story about a day camp. Headline is Siouxland Children Learn About Flight at Air Museum's Day Camp. Armando Grimaldo carefully folded and creased a yellow piece of paper into a dynamic dart Wednesday morning at the Mid-America Museum of Aviation and Transportation. When the paper airplane left the 10-year-old's hand, it flew somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 feet, landing on the concrete floor near a blue 1971 Chevy Camaro, which was parked among other vintage automobiles and aircrafts at the museum. "When I fly it, I put force in it to make it go like a real airplane," said Grimaldo, who remarked that she was surprised by how far the plane traveled. Grimaldo was one of more than a dozen 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders participating in Tennis Shoes on the Tarmac, a one-day STEM kids camp being led by Suzanne and Randy Bartles. Another session of the camp is slated for June 15th at the museum, which is located on the northeast corner of Sioux Gateway Airport. The 30,000 square foot facility, which opened in March 2010, once served as a B-17 training base for the Army Air Corps during the 1940s. Today, it features commercial aircrafts, classic automobiles, and military facts and memorabilia. I'd like to have them learn a little bit about flight and the dynamics of flight, and then I also like to introduce some different careers that they could possibly go into for flight, Suzanne Bartles said. They could be a pilot. They could be an air transportation person. There's a whole list of things they could do. Flight entails so much more than just simply getting in a plane and flying, according to Bartles. Before the children began making paper airplanes, she said they learned about pressure, lift, drag, and all of the dynamics associated with flying an airplane. By folding it in certain ways, they learned that the lift and the pressure can be adjusted by how you fold it. They've always been adjusting their plane, she said. While seated at 6 white tables, the children tried to fold and fly the Long Ranger, Flying Squirrel, Tailspin, and other paper airplanes. Some types involved several steps and were harder to make than others. Building styrofoam airplanes, flying rockets, and touring the Boeing 727 donated by FedEx Express was also on Wendy's agenda. Hayden Bulkey, 11, who noted that he has made paper airplanes in the past, described the tailspin as difficult, while Brogan Augustine, also 11, classified it as hard. James Greenwood, who was folding alongside Bulkey and Augustine, was the first of the trio to complete the tailspin. After launching his green paper plane into the air with all of his might, it spiraled in the air before swooping to the ground. "You guys are doing great," Bartles encouraged, as green, blue, and yellow planes flew through the air. "Just because you throw it hard doesn't mean it's going to go further. Try easy." And if you're interested or know someone that might be interested, it's called Tennis Shoes on the Tarmac, a STEM Kids Day Camp, part of the 727 STEM Learning Center sponsored by FedEx Express. The camp is for students entering or just completing 3rd through 5th grades. And it's from 9 a.m. to 3:30 on June 15th. It's at the Mid-American Museum of Aviation and Transportation at 2600 Expedition Court. The camp will be offering the history of flight, and students will create their own airplanes using various materials. They will learn about flight dynamics and the history of rocketry. Students will be experimenting with rockets while adhering to all safety protocols. The camp fees are $60 for museum members and $70 for non-members. Students will receive a t-shirt, their plane, and a rocket to take home with them. They are encouraged to bring a sack lunch or a box lunch can be purchased. And you can visit midamericamuseum.org for more information or to register. And our next story headline is Midland's Physicians to Join CNOS January 1st. CNOS, C-N-O-S, a physician-owned medical provider specializing in orthopedic services, sports medicine, and neurology, has announced that the physicians of Midland Clinics will join CNOS effective January 1, 2023. Midlands, which will take the CNOS name, specializes in cosmetic dermatology, gastroenterology, breast care, weight loss surgeries, wound care, and other treatments and procedures. Those will now be offered through CNOS, according to the press release. All 8 of Midland's physicians on staff will join on with CNOS. Operations will continue at Midland's clinics on Sioux Point Road in Dakota Dunes and at the cosmetic clinic on Sargent Road. Terms of the deal were not discussed. Last fall, CNOS announced a consolidation with Tri-State Specialists, a provider of orthopedic services. Both the Tri-State Specialists and Midland members were described as an alignment in CNOS announcements. And we'll move to Dear Abby, our first letter. Dear Abby, my daughter and her partner have 2 children, an 8-month and a 3-year-old. Whenever they get home, if a child is sleeping in the car seat, one of them will stay in the vehicle until the child wakes up. They don't want to bring the child inside the house because the child will wake up. They live in Los Angeles. The weather is nice, and they spend the time listening to music with earphones. Abby, they may end up staying in the car for 2 or 3 hours waiting. I say this is wrong, but I can't seem to convince my daughter or her partner, grandma in Texas. Abby responds, it is possible that your daughter and her partner regard the time they spend in the car as a rest period for themselves as well as the child. As parents of young children, they may need the break. Accept this as their parenting style and stay out of it because they are hurting no one. Dear Abby, 30 years ago, my wife and I moved from New York City to Albuquerque. I have four brothers. One has visited once, another has visited three times, but two brothers have never come out to see us. We have gone back east for weddings, funerals, and reunions. When I ask those two brothers why they don't visit, they say going to New Mexico is not on their bucket list or that their wives don't like to fly. I feel hurt and abandoned. Should I not care or just not deal with them? Signed, waiting for 30 years. Abby responds, not all siblings are equally close. You are blessed with two brothers who want to remain close and make the effort to do so. Your life will be happier if you concentrate on the relationships you have with them and their families and spend less time brooding about the others. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, June 12th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.